031899CV, Toll Dallas versus Brett Dusing and Elizabeth Dusing. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
It's actually, Dusing is correct, but somehow Edith's name got transferred to Elizabeth.
Oh, it's Edith? Okay. All right. You may want to let us know that so we can correct it in our system, because once it's in the system that way, I mean, the real people, the real people that matter, our legal assistants, will like, you know, so. And whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. This case concerns a home builder's right to compel a home's second owner to arbitrate negligence and DTPA claims regarding the design and construction of the home under the terms of a written warranty that was issued to the original home purchaser. I'd like to briefly set the stage for the issues that I'd like to focus on, and then go into two reasons why I believe that appellees are bound to arbitrate under the builder's warranty, even though they weren't parties to the original transaction. Those two reasons are that they assume the warranty, and then secondly, under direct benefits estoppel pursuant to the Supreme Court's opinion in NRA Weekly Homes. So, again, setting the stage briefly, the transactions are something that we should probably go over quickly, because there is a history here. The original homeowner was named Rodney Poole. He contracted with Toll Texas LP to build the home, and the home was completed in 2006. Under the agreement of sale between Poole and Toll Texas provided Mr. Poole with a limited warranty. In 2015, Mr. Poole sold the home to the Dusings, and the warranty was transferred to the Dusings as part of the sale. Procedurally, something to be mindful of is the fact that there was a prior appeal under the same cause number involving a different toll entity.
And can you tell me, in that prior appeal, did the Dusings take the position that they were not the assignees of the warranty, or was that raised? Do we know?
I don't believe the Dusings took the position that they were not the assignees. I think the issue was whether Toll Austin, the entity that was the appellant in that appeal, and we're representing Toll Dallas here today, whether Toll Austin had actually met its burden to show that there had been an assignment. And the court held that that Toll Austin had not met that burden to demonstrate.
The trial court found, or this court did in that prior holding?
This court did in the prior appeal.
Right.
Yes, so.
So that's why that, you're saying we're not bound by Toll One, I guess, is what we're going to be doing this?
That would be the principal reason. If you want to call that opinion Toll One, I'm totally on board with that, Justice Goodwin. One primary reason is we're not the same party. So therefore, we can't be bound by the court's opinion involving a different party besides Toll Dallas, who is here. But that plays into some issues that have been raised defensively, such as law of the case and so forth.
Right, and I mean, with the holdings, the principles asserted in the first Toll, the Toll Austin, why would those not control in this proceeding?
Well, the legal principles, if you're talking about the general burden of proof on an arbitration issue and, say, the standard of review, there's no dispute. There's no dispute that those are going to apply. The issue, from our perspective, is beyond that law. I mean, the law, the general law of the state of Texas is the law. The question that's been raised defensively by the Dusings here is whether the opinion in Toll One is law of the case. And we say it's not for several reasons.
Okay.
Just to go into what the Toll Austin or Toll One court held, I think that would maybe help clarify things. The court held that the Dusings were not successors merely because they purchased the home from Mr. Poole.
Right.
Okay, that was a clear holding. There was also a jurisdictional issue that's not relevant to this case. But the first primary holding was that merely purchasing the home from Mr. Poole did not make the Dusings successors so that they could be bound to the arbitration provision. And it's worth mentioning, I think, early on here, that we're not necessarily talking about the same arbitration provision. We point out in quite some detail in our brief that the court's opinion in Toll One treats, there's an arbitration agreement in the agreement of sale. There's also an arbitration agreement in the warranty. And in toll one, I think a mistake, respectfully, the court made was treating those as if they were one and the same and then calling them the toll pool agreement. We're here not to talk about the agreement of sale. We're here strictly to talk about the warranty. And if you look at those two documents together, the agreement of sale, if you start off on the timeline, and Mr. Poole entered into this agreement with Toll, so the agreement's in place. Well, at the moment that the transaction closed and the house belongs then to Mr. Poole, the agreement of sale essentially has no longer right. has any effect. It terminates. So and the documents are very clear on this, as laid out in our brief. What happens then is going on a go-forward basis, the document that governs the party's relationship is the warranty itself. And it's a pretty detailed document. I believe it's attached to our brief at Appendix C.
Can I ask you a question, Mr. Smith? So how, my understanding is that Toll Dallas' position is, or has been, the claims that you make are not governed, do not come under the warranty, correct? And if that's the case, then how can you argue your relief or what you're wanting doesn't come, your claims don't come under the warranty? However, we have to arbitrate it because under the same document that has the warranty, it says we have to arbitrate.
What they say is we're not making a warranty claim. That's not the same thing as making a claim that is or is not governed by an arbitration agreement in the warranty.
I'm sorry, maybe I wasn't clear. I understand that their position is we're suing in tort and we're not making a warranty claim. But mm-hmm. my understanding is that Toll Dallas expressly stated in their pleadings that they are, I'm sorry. No. My understanding is that Toll Dallas had told when they made a claim under the warranty, they had said those are not covered under the warranty.
Okay.
And so my question is, how does Toll, forget about what they're claiming, that sure. we're not under the warranty, how does Toll come to court and say we're denying those claims because they're not covered under the warranty, however, we are wanting you to force them to arbitrate under the warranty?
That goes back, Justice Triana, to the nature of the relationship between the agreement of sale and the warranty that I just described. What the key point in time in this case is the closing. And I've since learned that this is how builders do things frequently. You're contracting, you're building up to getting the house built, you close, and then what governs the relationship after the closing is a completely different document. And if you look at the warranty itself and even the agreement of sale, it's clear that the agreement of sale ends as of the date of closing and the warranty begins, and the entirety of the party's relationships, whether it's a warranty claim or any other type of claim, is governed under the warranty and that arbitration clause, which is a very, very broad clause. It's on CR page 595 is the operative provision, and the agreement says any disputes really between any affiliate on behalf of Toll and the Dusings are subject to binding arbitration. And it actually gives a laundry list of claims that are covered by this broad any disputes language. And the any disputes in the laundry list also specifically includes any alleged violation of consumer protection, unfair trade practice, or any other statute, which clearly encompasses the DTPA, which is one of the theories that they've asserted. And then another is in section E there, any allegation of negligence, which they have alleged negligence in the design and construction of the home. So we have to take a step back, I would submit, in response to your question, Justice Triana, and say, what is the general scope of arbitration as it's defined by the Texas legislature? There's a strong public policy favoring arbitration. And looking at an arbitration agreement like this, the courts have repeatedly held that broad language, like what you see in this warranty, I think you have to maybe get past the notion that this document is labeled a warranty, and they're saying we're not bringing a warranty claim, and understand that this is the entirety. This document is what governs the party's relationship, period. It specifically says you can't sue us. This is your sole
remedy. Okay, so let's just look at whatever you want to call it, that document. Am I understanding correctly that the pleadings, the total Dallas pleading said, the problems with your pool or the problems you are complaining of do not come under that document? Forget about it's a warranty or anything. Did I misread that or?
I think in the record there is, I know exactly what you're talking about. There were repairs requested, there were repairs made, and then there were repairs that, yes, told Dallas or told Texas, who administers the warranty, told the
rejected.
Pools, these aren't covered.
Right.
So I think the operative question is, does it make a difference whether the claims are actually covered under the warranty or not? And I submit to the court that the answer is very clear. The answer is no. It doesn't matter if it's covered under the warranty or not.
Because
but they do
of the
still
any dispute.
Exactly. In the laundry list that specifically identifies the claims being brought to the court. That's exactly it. To come back to what the Toll Austin court did, just to make sure that I cover those points and mm-hmm. we're clear.
Yes, please.
So they weren't successors in interest, as I said, merely because they purchased the home from Poole. The court also held that what I have come to call type one direct benefits estoppel did not require arbitration in this case. The court said that Toll Austin didn't meet its burden to establish that. Now, what is type one direct benefits estoppel? Well, the Supreme Court in Weekly Homes said there are two types. The first type is what we hear about so often, and that is, you know, someone's coming in and essentially filing suit on the contract, even though they're not a party.
Yeah. Right.
These are, yeah, it's not exactly third-party beneficiary, but it's like, I mean, the best examples are found in the cases, you know. And I think there's some case law that gives a great example. There's this Flores series of cases out of the Fourth Court of Appeals that hold that a nursing home resident, I'm actually getting into type two, excuse me. The type one types are what the court said in Toll Austin, which is you could bring this claim regardless of whether there was ever a contract. Mm-hmm. So here, I think what was argued in the Toll One case is we have DTPA and negligence claims for we're claiming defective construction and design. You don't really have to look at the contract to get at the merits of those claims. So, but importantly, in this case, and I jumped ahead of myself just a bit, we're not asserting type one. We're asserting under the warranty type two, which is someone who seeks or obtains direct benefits from a contract other than through a lawsuit. In Weekly Homes, the Texas Supreme Court said, you're not limited to claims being brought in a lawsuit to be, if you're a non-signatory to an arbitration agreement, you can still be compelled to arbitrate even if what you're doing is not suing under the contract. If you're seeking or obtaining direct benefits of the contract other than through a lawsuit, you may still be compelled. Now, back to my point about the nursing home cases. Those are the good examples of this type two direct benefits estoppel that I'm getting into. The nursing home resident is brought in and placed in the home. Someone else, a family member, a caregiver, is the one who signs the paperwork. The paperwork contains an arbitration clause. What those cases have held, and there, as I say, there are several of them under this Flores banner in the Fourth Court, that the resident's claims still have to be arbitrated, even though they are not the ones that signed the agreement, because they are there receiving the direct benefit of the contract. Here, what's gone on, and let me conclude this point, and then I'll move back to the assignment issue, because it is very important that I do that. We're asserting this second type. We didn't have any obligation but for this warranty, as I was explaining earlier, but the Dusings sought direct benefits under the warranty. Their realtor communicated with Toll about warranty inspections. They even amended their sales contract to specifically provide
the $30,000.
The warranty would be assigned, and any proceeds of warranty claims that were cash be distributed between them. Mr. Dusing, in July of 2015, emailed a request for warranty repairs, listing several different areas, and the language he used was per the terms of our warranty. And then the Dusing's attorney even later on sent a demand letter saying this is a demand pursuant to the warranty that was transferred to the Dusing's. There's really, under this type two, there really is no question that the Dusing sought direct benefits under the warranty. Now, the next question. And I think that's sufficient, by the way, to reverse and remand and have the trial court order this case to arbitration. The next question is, what benefits did they receive? So independently, there was an inspection conducted that Toll Dallas did not have to conduct. They owed no duties to these people outside of this warranty, according to the plain language of the documents. There were some repairs made to flashing to repair the leaks, and then Toll Dallas even paid an outside engineering firm, so it incurred expense to investigate this situation. This is very similar to what we've seen in these nursing home cases, where someone else is making the arrangement, and the party who is being asked to be compelled to arbitration is accepting a benefit of that arrangement, that contract or warranty contains an arbitration clause. So in our view, there's really no issue, no dispute that this case should have been compelled to arbitration. We also spent considerable time in our, just to wrap up, in our brief talking about an assignment. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to cover that in detail. If the court has questions about that, I'm happy to answer them. Otherwise, I'll be back for rebuttal.
Can I ask one question? Is that okay? How does the January 2018 D.R. Horton versus Mitchell case, how do you distinguish that?
It is distinguishable because that was a case in which the arbitration clause was contained in the agreement of sale and not in the warranty. And it's similar factually. We actually discussed this case in some detail in our reply brief, and we demonstrate the reasons why it does not apply here. But the biggest distinction is this case is about the warranty and not the agreement of sale, and that case is about the agreement of sale.
Thank you.
May it please the court. This case is about many things, one of which is, can a builder hold a subsequent purchaser to an agreement that, in this instance, in this appeal, a warranty that the builder didn't draft, that the subsequent purchaser never looked at, and that should not, and the trial court found, did not bind them to arbitration in this case. We feel the trial court did not err in denying the motion to compel arbitration for a variety of reasons. First, we contend that there's estoppel issues, and then the second issue also that we feel justifies the court's ruling is that the appellant did not meet its burden of showing and demonstrating that there was actually an agreement to bind arbitration. And that is where I think looking at the prior, if you want to call it Justice Goodwin, Toll 1, is important. Because I would submit that in that particular opinion, the court did look jointly at the sales agreement and the warranty. The sales agreement they want to run from, because it's clear from that opinion that the pleadings on file did not justify a direct benefits estoppel argument, didn't support it. But I think it is important to consider that in that opinion, both documents were part of the discussion and part of the analysis. So I think that is part and parcel with why we contend the case rule of the case applies, because the same two exceptions, there are six exceptions, as the court knows, to get around non-signatories being bound, it's the same two. We've got assumption, and we've got the direct benefits estoppel argument again being asserted in this particular instance. And what I'd like to do is spend just a moment to talk about the underlying facts as it applies to those two exceptions. We have a 10-year structural warranty, and that's important. It's structural. It's not cosmetic. It's not plumbing. It's not HVAC. It's structural. So you'll see in their argument that they take the position under the direct benefits part two analysis, if you will, that, sure, the Ducings sought to acquire benefits under the warranty, undisputed. Clearly they did. Just like any homeowner that's experiencing water flooding their basement would turn to the builder and say, what is the problem here? Do I have a warranty claim? They clearly did that. What is important to understand is when they did that, there was only 1 year left on the warranty, and that was a structural warranty. And so Exhibit W to the, I believe it was to the amended plea and motion to compel, Exhibit W to Toll's agreement, it includes a letter talking about the structural warranty. And what's important, my point is, I guess I'm doing a poor job of trying to explain it, is that the structural warranty does not apply to repairs for flashing on a Juliet balcony. It doesn't apply to painting. It doesn't apply to stucco work. And so in their argument, you'll see allusions to the record saying, hey, because that we did warranty benefit work, not only did the Ducing seek it, but they obtained it. And our position is, no, they didn't. There is evidence in the record that indicates, especially a letter from counsel that outlines all of the history of the different complaints. And in that letter, he clearly states it was a courtesy. Everything else is denied. And Justice Triana, I believe you picked up on that about it. That is the letter. I think it's clerk's record 239 to 243. But in that letter, Toll took the position that all that prior work wasn't covered, and everything that he's complaining about moving forward was not covered by the structural warranty. So our position with the direct benefits part two analysis is, yes, he did seek it, but he did not obtain structural warranty benefits. The only warranty benefits permitted to him in year 9 of the house.
Let me ask you a hypothetical question. Is it your position that the original owner, as long as he doesn't assert an actual breach of warranty claim, that he could avoid arbitration?
No, I don't think so, because he clearly signed the agreement of sale. That document had an arbitration clause. And in fact, that's what they tried. I don't know the answer to that, but when they tried to consolidate our case in front of Judge Crump, that issue came up. And the reason counsel for Toll said is because it's easier to consolidate because we can hold him to arbitrate. And so that was attempted and failed. And so my view, I think, is they could do that with him.
Well, let me ask you another hypothetical. So what if the pool had been, the home warranty for the pool had been purchased, pool had purchased the home warranty from a third, not the builder, but went and got another limited warranty. Do you say that it would not be assignable and that therefore, and assigned it, I'm sorry. Would you say then that your clients, if that was the case in the hypothetical, would not be bound by that contract?
No, I think that's an important distinction. He didn't do that. He didn't go out and buy a separate warranty. But if he did, yes, I think that they would be in that particular instance. If it was assigned to him and the other evidentiary issues were the same.
And then how would you differentiate just because it's the builder that gave this warranty versus Pool going out and purchasing a warranty, home warranty from somebody else?
Because of the fact that the arbitration clause... let me back up. I would say that in terms of this particular instance, because it was, you have to read the two documents together, the warranty and the sales agreement, that they're combined and there wasn't that situation. And in fact, in this, in our particular case, the warranty provision, if you look at the actual document, it's an automatic transfer. So there is no assignment. It wasn't as though you and I agree, I'll pay you extra money for this particular warranty. The warranty at issue was actually assignable automatically.
Well, then what was that in the I thought I saw something that said that there was a consideration of, I don't know how, like $30,000 for the warranty. Am I mistaken on
no,
what the record reflects?
There is a provision in the sales agreement that talks about if Poole were to get warranty repairs, he would pay. There was basically, when you buy a house, there's problems. They mm-hmm. identified the Juliet balcony leaks and said that if he goes ahead and tries to get them repaired, I believe that there was some compensation that might be allocated. But Poole, as my understanding at least, Poole did not do that. Poole did not make a warranty claim that I'm aware of and pursue that. But it's like any case where you have the inspector go out and look at your house and they find a myriad of problems.
And again, I'll ask the same question that I asked Mr. Smith. In the prior appeal, and did the Ducings take the position that they were not the assignees of the warranty? If so, do we know that here? Or?
I don't remember. We didn't okay. argue the appeal, and I just don't remember.
Does it make a difference?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I think the ruling is the same. So in terms of the direct benefit estoppel argument, clearly we didn't plead it. No pleadings have been made. There hasn't been any benefit obtained, and that's what the Weekly Homes decision, as I read it at least, indicates. And there is the Creative Arts case, which indicates that even if the claims arise solely from tort that are independent of the contract, that the direct benefits estoppel rule doesn't apply. And so that's what we're also contending in this case. In terms of the assumption exception in that argument, in this case, we also believe that the court's prior ruling applies because the sales agreement clearly says you cannot transfer or assign the agreement, which incorporates by reference the warranty. The warranty, however, does say that it transfers any remaining life does get transferred over to the new purchaser. And so I believe one implication from a decision granting reversing the trial court's ruling would be a situation where any time a subsequent purchaser buys a home with a warranty with time left on it, and that warranty says, hey, it's got to be transferred over to the new buyer the remaining terms, and that warranty includes an arbitration clause, you're stuck. There is no out. That is the consequence of their position, as I understand it. And that happens in every situation. And here, what we're arguing is not a warranty claim. We're arguing because they've told us, or they told my clients, these aren't warranty claims. And so what we're arguing is that the French drain that they buried 4 feet around the uphill side of the house that we didn't discover until after we bought it was done negligently. It was done inappropriately. And so those duties are not the same as duties under the contract, duties under the warranty. And so an independent basis exists for us to move forward with this case. That's why their efforts to get us into arbitration, I believe, have failed five previous times. And so from our perspective, the record, we believe, did have evidence in the sales agreement, in the warranty language. If you look at structural defects, if you look at the transfer clause, the letters from counsel indicating that these aren't covered, that you didn't get a benefit, this is just a courtesy, we did it gratuitously. It does support and provide a record for the trial court to deny that they met the principal burden of showing that there is an agreement to arbitrate. And that's our primary position with respect to that.
What about the any dispute language and the actual warranty that talks about, you know, whether it's DTPA or any other type of disputes? Why is that not controlling?
I think it's inherently, if I understand that language, it's one of the provisions is basically any claim between the parties will be covered by the warranty. I think you have to have, it fundamentally presumes that you have a warranty claim, and we don't have a warranty claim. So normally in these cases that I've been doing for 20 years, You sue for the warranty, you sue a breach of warranty, and then you also throw in negligence, DTPA claims, other things that if the Residential Liability Construction Act doesn't apply to, you can use to compensate the homeowner. And so that language, any other dispute, would conceivably involve if a foreman went out to the house to look at the repair request and they got into a tussle with the homeowner and assaulted him, the assault would have to be arbitrated the way that language in the document reads. And that's exactly why the court should be reluctant to impose on a non-signatory that type of burden. So, yes, Judge.
I'm just thinking about the 10-year. Then why would... Never mind.
Okay.
Thank you.
So the two exceptions, it's our position that they were not proven, and that my colleague and his client did not satisfy that burden. In terms of the equitable arguments with estoppel and law of the case, I think the record is pretty well developed about the number of times that this argument has come up in the trial court, and once again with this court. Law of the case, as the court knows, is a judicial remedy that a trial court can adhere to help make rulings that are consistent and efficient, and so that we don't have to keep coming back up time and time again.
And should we impose that equitable doctrine against somebody who is not a party to the original?
No.
Appeal?
No, you shouldn't if you find that they weren't a party to the original appeal. And it's our position that they were, given that their pleadings indicated that any decision by the Court of Appeals would apply to not only Toll Austin, but also all the toll affiliates. And you'll see in our briefing that repeatedly throughout this case, that's been the situation. In fact, we were perplexed when, after this court issued its opinion number one and came down, they went to Judge Naranjo and said, "Judge, we want you to reconsider your initial decision denying our motion to compel arbitration." And she looked at them and said, are you serious? Because the Court of Appeals has just said I'm correct. And they said, "Yeah, we are." And then after she denied that, Toll Dallas then filed their motion to compel arbitration, as we saw it, at least as a backup position, to try to get the case ultimately back into court. But it's the same corporate board, it's the same registered agent, it's the same company. It was a clear case of misnomer that when the stay of the pleading stay after all the appeals were expired, we immediately amended, I believe it was in December of 2017, at which case the motion to reconsider and the subsequent appeal came. So yes, I would say that if you find that they're different parties, I would have to submit that the law of the case does not apply. If there are no other questions, I'll...
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Let's come back briefly to the assumption issue, because I think that really is the dispositive argument here. We talked a lot about direct benefits estoppel type two, and it, you know, I'm not conceding that we don't win on that point, because I think we do. I think we've proved that they sought benefits that would only have been entitled to under the warranty, and they even acquired substantial benefits. Look at the case law, and we would urge the court to rule in our favor on that issue, but I think the assumption really answers the question even more clearly. And going back to the Toll 1 opinion, the court's concern there was we don't see any evidence of an assignment. The court basically treated the assumption issue as requiring an assignment between the parties. What we have here, I think the Deusings have argued away their case, because what they have said in their briefing and in this court is, oh, well, you know, we don't know really know about an assignment, but the warranty automatically transferred to us. I'm not sure I agree with that, because the warranty does say the warranty will transfer, and there is a provision that says that they will provide, or that Pool, as the original purchaser, would provide it to them. But I think the amendment to their contract certainly closes the book on that question. That evidence did not, I mean, I don't represent Tull Austin, but that evidence did not come to light until after this court issued its mandate following the Tull 1 opinion. And so what we could, Tull Austin, I guess, could or couldn't prove at the time is really not relevant to what's going on here. We have, the other thing about the warranty is that it defines beneficiary to include later owners specifically, and that's at CR 588, and the warranty and arbitration process is binding on assigns. Well, if the warranty automatically transferred, and if they as a separate side deal negotiated a transfer of the warranty, Toll Brothers warranty to transfer at closing, or the exact words used in that amendment to the contract, then clearly they've been assigned the warranty. And if that is the case, then they step straight into Mr. Poole's shoes. They have no greater right or lesser right than what Mr. Poole had when this deal was closed. And Mr. Poole, even they say, Mr. Poole would have been obligated to arbitrate. And so coming back to the question of, and by the way, in their brief, they admit that the warranty was transferred to them at page 29. We would submit that that's really the end of the inquiry, and the court doesn't really need to analyze any other issues. That should be sufficient. Going back to the scope, we're having some confusion, I think, to whether the warranty is covered, or whether we're talking about warranty work versus the scope of an arbitration agreement, and those are not the same thing. The actual scope of the warranty, if they don't agree with whether something is covered or not, they have a remedy. It's to go to arbitration. They're trying to fight their obligation to go to arbitration. And I can appreciate that, but it's not that they are left without a remedy if they disagree with what's being offered to them. But under contract law and decades of jurisprudence favoring arbitration in this state, this broad arbitration clause clearly provides for arbitration of this dispute. It does provide for arbitration of any disputes. And on the second line under Roman numeral 8, binding arbitration procedure, it specifically identifies disputes concerning the design or construction of the home. Well, they've sued for negligence, DTPA, based on the design or construction of the home. The only question before this court, it's not what relief they should get. It's not even whether the claims they have made were covered by the warranty or are warranty claims. The only issue before this court is who gets to decide. Is it going to be an arbitrator, which is what this arbitration provision we say clearly provides for, and the evidence is conclusive. There's no record that would have allowed the trial judge to reach the conclusion that it did, respecting that trial judge immensely. But we've given the court two grounds. And this doesn't even get into whether the agreement is covered. It clearly is.
Well, let me ask you a question. So if we were to agree with you, then Toll Dallas would go to arbitration and Toll Austin would stay in court?
Well, that's objectively, sitting where I sit today, I would say that shouldn't have been the outcome. I would say that this agreement should have been applied to Toll Austin, and Toll Austin should have been allowed to go to arbitration too. And yes, there apparently was a motion to reconsider filed in the trial court, and the trial judge did not see fit to grant that, and that was her ruling. Now, what I think, to address your question, Your Honor, the court really shouldn't be concerned about that, because that happens in litigation all the time, where some party's entitled to go to arbitration and a party who is presently not before the court may not be. But I think what was represented at the beginning of the case was that the Deucings had sued the wrong party. It really should not have been Toll Austin. Toll Austin shouldn't have ever been in the case. Toll Dallas, according to Toll Austin's own verified pleading, was the correct defendant. So the party who's before you today is the party that should be answering to the Dusings allegations in some form or fashion. What happens when this case is done?
And they're getting the benefit of the arbitration clause under this analysis, Austin is not.
My client, Toll Dallas, should get the benefit of the arbitration clause. It's brought forth evidence that was not available at the time that this court decided Toll won. And the result, for all the reasons we've detailed in our brief, Toll won does not bind this court on law of the case. The defenses don't even apply because they're not even valid defenses, but I'll have to defer to my brief on that. The Supreme Court doesn't recognize those defenses to arbitration. Unless the court has further questions, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.